It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio, carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site, the links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. My 15-minute story and opinion show, John Mack's Radio Rants, are produced as The Spirits Move Me, and they may also be accessed by going to my website, once again, www.johnmack13.com, and clicking the John Mack's Radio Rants tab for an index of shows. At the end of this evening's show, we'll be taking calls at 646-716-9756, and you can call at any time, but I'll pick the caller up at the end of our discussion. My guest next week on this show is educated computer scientist and political activist Janine Meyer. Tune in and listen. My guest tonight is writer, educator, critic, novelist, and cartoonist M.G. Lord. I've known M.G. for over 30 years, but only through her works, going back to her days as Newsday, the main newspaper of Queens and Long Island, New York, and most recently I've known her through Facebook. Since those Queens days, she has written widely for other publications, including the New York Times, Discover, Travel and Leisure, Vogue, Art News, the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Book Review, the Los Angeles Times Book Review, the Hollywood Reporter, and the New Yorker. She's also written the moving memoir of her teenage years, as well as cultural studies of how Elizabeth Taylor and Barbie have shaped our culture even without our recognition. She is now the lecturer in the Master of Professional Writing program at the University of Southern California. We'll explore her life and work in depth tonight on the John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, MG, and welcome to the show.
Hi, John. It's great to be here.
But let's start right there. How did you come to be MG rather than your given whole name? By the way, what does MG stand for?
My name is Mary Grace Lord. If someone did that to you, you probably wouldn't use it either. I stopped using it formally, I guess when I was about age 8 in the third grade, when some astonishingly irritating nun pointed out to my entire class that my name was every other word in the Hail Mary. And she pointed it out by soliciting answers from the class, like Hail, and then the class filled in Mary, full of grace, and the class finally filled in the Lord is with thee. This was traumatizing, as you can imagine, for an 8-year-old, and I marched home to my home in La Jolla, California, and I advised my parents that I wanted to go to public school and that I was beginning to get my head around this thing called secular humanism, and I thought I might be a secular humanist.
Now, let's start right there, back to the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in La Jolla, which is now very much a posh beach community, and the only people, it seems, who can afford real estate there are deposed Latin American dictators, drug lords, and Deepak Chopra. My classmates and I can't really afford the houses we grew up in. But it was a beautiful place in the 1960s and just undergoing a transition. I mean, it had almost been a bedroom community for the major aerospace companies that were located farther south in San Diego. But in the early 60s, the Salk Institute set up for business there in that beautiful Louis Kahn building, and the University of California at San Diego opened, and the character of La Jolla changed. But it was kind of a beautiful place to grow up. As a consequence, I think as an adult, I have a very strong allergy to beautiful views of the ocean and lawns. I prefer to live in places where there is razor wire.
Now, did you get to transfer to public school, or did they keep you in Catholic school?
No, I moved to public school, you know, at that point. Then I think they were probably pleased to save a little money.
Then you went to both.
But, you know, and I was going to say, in the 1960s, the public schools in Southern California were great. I mean, before the election of Governor Reagan, they were fantastic schools. When I was in La Jolla, I was in this extraordinary class with 15 kids that drew from all over the San Diego school district. And people were assigned to this class, fourth, fifth, and sixth grades, based on their Stanford-Binet IQ tests long before the way things are today. You know, three-year-olds are coached on their IQ tests. But this was an amazing mix of kids, and we had no structure whatsoever. And the class itself, I mean, you would have thought with the Salk Institute and UCSD that the students would primarily be the children of professors and scientists, but not at all. They were children of bus drivers and retired submarine engineers, and it was an extraordinary mix of students. We've actually reconnected now as a group on Facebook to discuss, you know, what this experience meant to us. Actually, probably the most famous or the most, in our view, successful in our group is the physicist Bob Penner, who used to be at USC, where I am, but then he got his own institute in the Netherlands, which really trumped anything the rest of us could even aspire to do.
And you went to public high school also then, I guess.
Right, and when my mother died, we moved to Long Beach, California, which was certainly less of a posh resort area than La Jolla was. And I went to an inner city school in the early 1970s that was characterized by a lot of racial conflict. It's sort of fun now to point out that I went to the same high school as Snoop Dogg or Snoop Lion or whatever he's calling himself these days.
In your 2005 memoir, AstroTurf, you write of your mother's terminal cancer and your father immersing himself in his work at the Jet Propulsion Lab. That must have been a very difficult time in your life. Would you set that scene for us?
Well, it was extraordinarily difficult. And I think part of it was just that I was very young. I'm an only child, and both of my parents were much older when I was born. My father was in his 50s, and my mother was in her late 30s. And she herself had dropped out of graduate school in chemistry and become a 1950s housewife, which I don't think ever really made her terribly happy. They were both very much committed to their Catholicism. I mean, it was very much an identity thing, although they did liberate me to go to public school. But in any event, my father was a rocket engineer, and he very much embraced the values associated with masculinity during the space age. Those values were, of course, thinking over feeling, repression over emotion, workplace over family. So when his life at home, because of my mother's severe illness, became difficult, he threw himself into his work, leaving me between the ages of 10 and 14 to deal with essentially a dying 50-year-old woman. And my book, which I think you're reading now, has been called by reviewers a, quote, odyssey of forgiveness, unquote. But I assure you, that was not my intention when I began the project. I ended up doing this book. I was not a science writer, but Forever Barbie, my first book, A Cultural History of the Barbie Doll, that also looked at its very squalid business story. And finally, had endnotes and footnotes for all the apocryphal stories about the invention of the doll. This book had sold very well, so publishers were eager to support me on a second project, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And then I realized the one thing that I was still curious about, never mind that I was already in my 30s and my mother had been dead for many years, I wanted to know where that damn man, my father, went during those critical years. So I ended up writing A Cultural History of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. That's part family memoir, but that also looks at its really strange history and what had happened there during the time when I spent a lot of time there. I ended up becoming close over several years because other things like a divorce were going on in my life that caused me to be less able to focus on the manuscript. And I had this pass that permitted me to spend time during the day and during the night at the lab. And I hung out with the team that eventually landed the Mars exploration rover Spirit and Opportunity on Mars in 2004. And over time, I have to admit that I came to understand exactly what had so riveted my father about his work, because it completely riveted me.
The New York Times really liked the book writing. AstroTurf works well as a brief, clear history of a field and the lab that embodied it. It works even better as a piece of cultural criticism. It works best of all, though, as a moving memoir of the difficult love between the daughter and the father. That's a good review.
I think so. I was happy.
All of MG's books, by the way, are available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble online.
And Powell's, so we can plug the independent
one. You write about your father's expectations that you would remain as a surrogate wife and housekeeper, but you were able to escape to college. Tell us about your college years. What did you major in, and did you also write in college?
I loved college. I connived. I wanted to go to art school. I did many chores in high school. I edited the newspaper. I was on the swim team. Kind of amazing, because I also kept house for my father, cooked for him, you know, did all those domestic chores, but still managed to, you know, have kind of a normal presence in high school. But my real passion when I was in high school was cartooning, especially political cartooning. I was the kid in the back of the class who drew the malicious pictures of the teacher, and they actually looked like the teacher. And my goal in high school was to become a political cartoonist. And going to Yale, my father did not want me to go to an art school. And actually, I'm grateful that he put his foot down, because Yale is a first-rate art school and has a terrific graduate school of art. But it's also, you know, a university renowned for its sciences and liberal arts. So I double majored in history and studio art. And I was the cartoonist for the Yale Daily News. And after I graduated, somewhat to my astonishment, and in part, I think, because of efforts on the part of two wonderful, well-known mentors who helped me during my college years, Bill Malden, the best known for his World War II cartoons, and Gary Trudeau, who in the 70s was still living in New Haven, I ended up leaving college and getting a job at Newsday, which was the Long Island newspaper, which was then the ninth largest newspaper in the country, to be its political cartoonist. And this was, you know, this was fantastic. I felt like I had been rewarded for those very challenging high school years.
Gary Trudeau was a Yale classmate of the son of Bill Beinecke and the Beinecke family. Bill Beinecke was one of my consulting clients, and the Beinecke family is responsible for the Beinecke Laboratory at Yale.
The library, which is unbelievably beautiful. I think it was always, from the beginning, my favorite building there, with that translucent marble. I love rare books and manuscripts, and I think I fell in love with them at the Beinecke.
And Gary Trudeau's father is a doctor that's responsible for an institute up in upstate New York, and the Beinecke family is a big supporter of this medical research institute, which I forget what the actual focus of it was.
Wasn't it near Saranac Lake, if I'm remembering correctly?
Okay. I remember well your cartoons in Newsday and also your occasional columns. Tell us about your years there.
It's interesting. I sort of ascended to be their editorial page cartoonist in 1980, about the same time that Ronald Reagan was elected president. And the kind of energy that one has in one's 20s was really well-suited to political cartooning because at the time, you know, one had to generate 5 cartoons a week. And I was not a huge fan of Republicans, so every morning when I had to wake up at 6 in the morning when the Times hit the door, remember paper, newspapers, I lived in Manhattan, I'd get up, I'd read the news, and I'd get angry. And then I'd usually drive to Newsday, or later on, Newsday had an office in Manhattan. But when I first started working, I commuted often between Manhattan and the Newsday office on Long Island. But you needed a lot of energy to get that angry 5 days a week. And I also had studied writing at Yale. I mean, you know, I'd studied history. I'd worked with William Zinsser, a really extraordinary writer who wrote many books and pieces for The New Yorker, as well as John Hersey, whom I consider probably as much a man. You know, I think these men, these really benign men from the World War II generation, Bill Mauldin and John Hersey, had a huge impact on me. And I also wanted to write. And my editors at Newsday began to notice by, I guess, sort of the late 80s, that I was beginning to shove novels into the talk balloons of my cartoons. And we worked out an arrangement where I would do 4 cartoons a week and be permitted to write, you know, a humor column weekly. And that was a good arrangement for me, and it was a good arrangement for them. And out of one of those columns came the contract for Forever Barbie.
I know that you published a collection of your political cartoons, Mean Streets, in 1982. What made you leave full-time cartooning?
I left when Forever Barbie was successful in 1994. And in 1994, you could sort of see the handwriting on the wall for newspapers. 1994 was the year that Slate, which had been much poo-pooed, suddenly took off as a really reliable news source. And I mean, to me, it seemed like the days of the power of newspapers were numbered. And I wanted to make my exit before everything crashed and burned around me. And Forever Barbie gave me the opportunity to do so. I thought I would continue to draw more over the years, but people mostly wanted me to write. So I wrote Forever Barbie and a lot of articles on gender and culture. And after AstroTurf, which it was a moving memoir, but you also learn how to get a spacecraft to another planet, I started doing a lot of science stories. And now, actually, I have brought together all of my interests. I'm working on a graphic novel, it's not exactly like a political cartoon, because sequential art, you know, it tells a story over many pages. It's not like a cartoon, which distills an emblematic experience to represent a whole story. So it's kind of different, but I'm drawing again, and I'll be cryptic, but I will say it deals with space exploration, and there are no people in it. It is set in my idea of an ideal world.
Then you weren't a victim. Then you weren't a victim of the cutbacks there after the paper was caught kiting circulation. I remember that my friend Susan. Susan Cheever was one of the victims.
No, I think I jumped ship before they had the opportunity to push me off the gangplank, because I thought would put me in a stronger position.
Okay. You wrote Prig Tales, Your Guide to Surviving the Self-Righteous 90s in 1990. Tell us about that book.
I'm amazed you even know that book, John. That was one of those books that I did really quickly because we needed to remodel a bathroom. But it's a combination of writing and drawing. And I did, it seems probably just as vital today as it was in the early 90s. It's about how not to be a prig, you know. I think the early 90s saw the beginning, or not even the beginning, really, the ascendancy of recovery culture in Los Angeles. You know, all the people who had terrible drug habits, you know, the studio executives addicted to cocaine and so forth, were all going to AA and NA meetings to get sober. And there was a similar pattern in New York. So it became, it became very expedient for careerists, whether they had substance abuse problems or not, to suddenly start showing up at these meetings. And I think the early 90s, too, saw, I think, actually a good sort of attention directed toward proper nutrition and not smoking. I mean, I think those are all good things, but the sort of the frenzy about no alcohol seemed a little over the top.
You then had a hiatus in books for 14 years before Forever Bobby. What had you occupied during that time?
Well, wait a minute. Prig Tales was published in 1990 and Barbie came out in 1994. I think that's 4 years.
Okay. It's listed on your on your webpage as 2004.
Oh, no. 2004 was the 10th anniversary edition.
Okay.
The first edition was published by Morrow in 1994. And it was a huge amount of fun because nobody really looked at the doll or verified the crazy stories. And it really is an extraordinary business story, John. I mean, the doll was invented by Ruth Handler, who co-founded Mattel with her husband. She had the chutzpah to look at this, essentially a German porn doll, a doll based on a character in a German newspaper cartoon. In the Bild Zeitung, which is kind of a downscale German newspaper like our National Enquirer. And this character was just a total hooker. I mean, the character's name was Lily. So Ruth saw this Lily doll when she was traveling in a German-speaking country, she says Switzerland, because in 1955 or 56, American Jews generally didn't own up to traveling extensively in Germany. But in any event, the character was based on this, the doll was modeled on this hooker character in a German newspaper. I mean, just to sort of, this was not Barbie. I speak German. I read about 5 years of the cartoon, and in almost every panel, the Lily character was trading sexual favors for money with all of these jowly fat cats. The emblematic cartoon, I don't remember if I reproduced it in the book, but I'm sure I described it, was one of Lily completely naked in the apartment of a female friend, holding up a tiny newspaper, I believe it was the Bild Zeitung, to cover her naked body. And the caption is, "We had a fight, and he took back all his presents." But Ruth saw this doll. Yeah, exactly. This is not the personality of Barbie. Ruth saw this doll and, this adult, this very slutty adult doll, and convinced the male toy executives at Mattel that this is what little girls wanted. The trick, though, would be to have a different imagined identity projected onto her, where Lily was openly a streetwalker. Barbie had that wonderful – Barbie was an emblem of the conflicting values of 1957, not the year she was introduced, but the year that she was conceived. Imaginary personality was conceived. I mean, she had to look, she had to look incredibly seductive, the way American girls have always been pressured to look pretty and seductive to men. But she had to have a wholesome American girl personality that was completely at odds with that slutty body. But anyway, the business. So Ruth Handler and Mattel made a bundle on this doll. Mothers didn't like it, but kids adored it. And she was riding high until the early 70s, when she had some health problems. She had a mastectomy. She was the president of the company. And things kind of got out of control. She became the biggest white-collar felon in the state of California before Michael Milken. She cooked the books and eventually pleaded no contest to accusations of conspiracy, mail fraud, and falsifying SEC information. She did, if I remember correctly, something like 57,000 hours of community service, and then went on. This is where the story becomes truly hilarious. She went on to make a second fortune designing mastectomy prostheses, or as she said to me about 20 years ago over lunch at the Beverly Hills Country Club, the Hillcrest Country Club, she said, "Honey, all my life I've gone from breast to breast."
What initially attracted you to what must be the most world's most famous doll, or at least the world's most famous big-chested doll?
Well, probably the fact that an editor was extremely interested in my writing about the doll. I think there were three things that made Forever Barbie successful. One was the business story, which no one had ever really looked at closely, and which is hilarious. And also, I don't want to sound like I'm denigrating Ruth Handler. I think in many ways her chutzpah and her bravery and her willingness to defy convention were great, especially during the years when she was working on the mastectomy prostheses, because it was during precisely those years that my own mother had breast cancer and died from it. And I remember the secrecy and shame that surrounded the illness. And Ruth Handler would have none of that. She went on TV talk shows like, remember Mike Douglas, John?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, well, she went on the Mike Douglas show, and she invited him with his hands to determine which of her breasts was real. I mean, she was completely out there, and she made it possible for, you know, the current breast cancer awareness movement that exists today, I think, by taking this illness out of the shadows and not being ashamed of it. That's probably a digression. But, I think there were three things. The business story was fascinating. That's one part of it. Another part of it was that a lot of artists who had grown up in the late 50s and early 60s were beginning to use Barbie as symbols in their work. Visual artists, novelists and short story writers like A.M. Holmes. So I would say that's the second component. And the third component was that the doll may have been and still is a symbol of international consumer capitalism, but in the minds of individual children, the doll could mean something unique. It could have a precise symbolic meaning that didn't really have to do with its meaning in the larger culture. And this was the case for me. The article I wrote was about opening the moldy vinyl sarcophagi, the doll cases that contained my own dolls that I had played with during the years that my mother was dying of breast cancer. My father had just put a bunch of things, including those dolls, in storage when we moved. And I was in New York in my early 30s, and he sent these things to me. For a long time, I didn't open the cases, and then I did. And I was kind of horrified. The dolls were baroquely cross-dressed. Ken was wearing Barbie's Solo in the Spotlight, a slinky black chanteuse outfit that tapered to a tutu at the ankles on Barbie, but on Ken that sort of fell mid-calf, very low cut with long gloves. And Barbie and her not-so-attractive sidekick Midge were wearing what I would have worn for 20 years in storage, Ken's khaki trousers, oversized man's shirt, and navy blue blazer. They looked like refugees from a boys' boarding school. Anyway, I thought, well, you know, my first thought was I must have had a lot more gender dysfunction in my childhood home than I remembered. But I lugged these things on the subway up to my Park Avenue psychoanalyst. Just as an aside, in case you ever want a seat on a crowded subway, I suggest you look like a slightly addled woman in your mid-30s carrying an armload of Barbie cases, and people just totally shy away from you. But anyway, looking at what was going on in my life and looking at the dolls, I realized it wasn't gender dysfunction. I cross-dressed the dolls to protect them. The idea was sort of like Passover. I mean, if the female doll's breasts were camouflaged, maybe the disease would pass them by. And Ken, male doll, was allowed that luxury of feminine exposure because he wasn't vulnerable in the same way. And this made me realize that there were the three things necessary, I think, for a really interesting book: great business story, artistic appropriation, and the way that the doll had been used, and what the doll could mean to individuals, including grown-up individuals who did have some creepy sexual issues with that little plastic thing.
There have recently been some changes in Barbie's both appearance and general ambience. What's your feelings on them?
Well, I don't actually think they're all that significant. I think that, you know, at Mattel, as in Ecclesiastes, there really is nothing new under the sun. I mean, they introduce things that as new that are similar to things that came out 20 years earlier when I was working on the book, and 20 years earlier in the first years of the doll. I think that the marketing to children very much relies on the fact that a new generation is born every 20 years, so they'll buy into the idea of newness. One of my favorite things this year, though, was Barbie, the Barbie doll being featured in Sports Illustrated. And I think this was a gigantic triumph for the AARP that, you know, a female thing as old as Barbie, born in 1959, you know, would be considered worthy to be in the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, don't you?
Yeah. I'll ask you a question as an insider that millions have asked before. What's the real story with Barbie and Ken?
Mattel had them break up around 2004 because Barbie was having her, you know, her 45-year-old Beverly Hills matron midlife crisis, and she took up with this appalling youngster named Blaine, and then you know, elaborately there was a publicity campaign several years later to bring Barbie and Ken back together, billboards everywhere, webisodes involving Barbie and Ken, and it would have been a piece of marketing genius except for the fact that Barbie and Ken's reunion, their getting together, coincided with the Arab Spring, which meant that the soft news portion of all the morning news programs and everything, which otherwise would have featured Barbie and Ken, instead featured commentators in burqas, you know, talking about the effect on women of what was going on in Egypt, etc. So it was kind of, it wasn't exactly a backfiring of their marketing, because the marketing definitely drew attention to Barbie and Ken, but they didn't get the kind of free publicity they would have gotten. Mattel didn't get the kind of free publicity had there not been, you know, a major crisis going on in the world.
Assuming I have the 2005 date correct for AstroTurf, then you didn't have the book for 11 years. What was going on during that time? What were you doing?
Wait. I think I mentioned that I was moving to California. I was doing a lot of, you know, journalism. But it was hard for me to focus on that book. And, you know, John, it was it wasn't so hard to, you know, I thought it would be very challenging to deal with the orbital mechanics and the physics of getting a spacecraft to another planet. But that was a piece of cake. The really challenging part was looking long and hard at my own family and my relationship with my father, you know, and putting personal details into what otherwise would have been a book written at arm's length, and I think it would have been a much less interesting book. Because Well, during the space age, I mean, you know, even the communication, it's kind of great that we're having this conversation on the anniversary of the moon landing. What was that, 45 years ago?
Yes.
Was it 45? Yeah, 45 years ago. The astronauts almost sounded robotic in their conversations with Houston. And the whole idea of masculinity was so involved with thinking and not with having emotion. And I had to look at this time and say, you know, what's wrong with it? And one of the big what's wrong with it aspects was the terrible damage it did, not just to my own family, but to the families of other engineers, especially in 1972, when the last, Apollo flight was made, and these men who had thrown themselves into their work, rarely seeing their families, suddenly came back, and they didn't really have a lot of work. I mean, you know, the energy, you know, we weren't going to Mars after we had successfully and repeatedly landed on the moon. That was just not necessary. The moon landing was a piece of theater in the Cold War, as you well know. Essentially, the Cold War was won on this day 45 years ago. And what happened in 1989 with the fall of the Berlin Wall was just a formality. I mean, our technical triumph in 1969, I think, was what won the Cold War. I'm getting a little off track here, but the casualty to the men who were so focused on this, and so many men were so focused on this, is that in 1972 they came back a little stunned. Their babies were now in high school or college and a little irritated at these men who were allegedly their fathers, whom they hadn't seen for years. So it wasn't just, you know, in my family, the anguish was probably more exaggerated because my father had not been around when my mother was dying, and I had pretty much been alone having to deal with something monumental. But I think that some version of what I felt afflicted the families of so many people involved in Apollo and other aspects of intense aerospace engineering during the space age.
I can see that, but I can also see that I've seen that in other industries. I was a technologist and a programmer and a manager and an officer on Wall Street, and there was tremendous pressure to have to spend the time developing the best systems with the least amount of money, weekend work, night work, over the years. And it was while you were doing it, and I can identify with what your father must have felt, it was very important to us. We were doing something very important. Now, if you step back and if you go 100 years into the future and you look back and the history books, then maybe the Kennedy assassination and the Civil Rights Movement, there won't be who put in a tremendous brokerage accounting system for Morgan Stanley. But there was this great pressure. And then all of a sudden, In recent history, there's been merges, particularly because of the extreme cost of computer technology, and there's also been tremendous outsourcing to India and to other places. And all of a sudden, these people who, if they're still around, see the jobs go away, and many technical errors. If you worked in chemical engineering, the Kodak, and you put everything into it, then all of a sudden the digital camera killed you. We're in an age of creative disruption, and it's killing
absolutely
jobs.
Absolutely, really, really, really big changes. And I don't actually think it's bad to focus that intensely on work. But I do think now at places like JPL, men are not necessarily severely punished if they want to spend a little bit of time with their families. And some women are in leadership positions. I don't think there's parity. 1972 was a really big year in my view, in my family because the Apollo program ended, but also 1972 was the year that Title IX passed. which changed so much for, you know, it was Title IX, an amendment to the Education Code, which basically said that schools couldn't discriminate against people based on sex. And I went to Yale, but Yale, seeing the handwriting on the wall, had become co-ed before the formal passing of Title IX. But Title IX opened so many things to women, and it definitely affected, I think, the worlds of science and technology, because suddenly, you know, your contracts, your federal contract might be dependent on a demonstration that you weren't severely and openly discriminating against women. I mean, in the old days at JPL, it was, you know, women really did almost nothing on the technical side. They ran those big Friden calculators, which antedated computers. There were whole rooms of them, you know, operating
these
Friden
calculators.
They were
called
contometers. Oh, is that what they were called?
My mother had been a contometer operator, yeah.
At the Jet Propulsion Lab, they competed once a year in a beauty contest along with some of the clerks and secretaries for the title of Misguided Missile. I had some T-shirts made when AstroTurf came out that I would give out at book events of the, you know, the pageantry around the Misguided Missile pageant, actually. And later, in 1958, when NASA was formed, the Jet Propulsion Lab became the place, the NASA. Actually, it's not technically a NASA facility. It's funded by NASA, but it's a part of Caltech, and it's managed by Caltech. So although it's similar to, say, the Johnson Space Center, it's not exactly identical in terms of its management structure. But JPL was responsible for all the important robotic space missions. And it continues to be responsible for robotic missions as opposed to human missions. I hate the word manned missions. I always say human missions. Because I think there's no need to really overdo the gender on that.
You mentioned these changes. My wife grew up in Philadelphia and then went to high school in the late 1950s. And her high school was the first high school in the country to have computer courses, and she applied to, and she was very interested in the sciences, and she applied to Lehigh for engineering, and she got this very nice letter back saying that she had excellent qualifications, but she must understand that Lehigh doesn't meet females. 35 years later, my daughter went to Lehigh.
I think that is a fantastic story. Well, you know, I never really understood. My mother had been in graduate school in chemistry during the war. She had a close friend who's no longer alive, Betty Nolan. And I never really talked as an adult with my mother about why she never finished her PhD. But I did, you know, get in touch with her friend Betty. And Betty explained to me kind of what had happened. You know, Betty had worked for a paint manufacturer in New Orleans during the war, making a waterproofing compound for tents. And at the end of the war, her supervisor gave her this astonishing backhanded letter of recommendation. It said, "We had to fire Miss Nolan because if we had kept her on, we would have had to make her a supervisor, an unsuitable job for a woman." I mean, you know, at the end of World War II, men had no qualms about putting this in writing. And I think the same was true for many women, particularly on scholarships, who were in graduate school in scientific fields. All of a sudden, the hierarchy looked at them, and it was sort of like, what are you doing here? You know, the real scientists have come back from the war. Get out of the way. And I think that may have been, you know, that kind of broke my mother in a certain way. And I can understand that.
When Johnny comes marching home again, we'll all turn out. Then 4 years later, in 2009, you co-authored an opera, another wide divergence of what you've been doing. How'd you get into that?
Well, it's actually an opera about the 110 freeway, and one of the characters is a JPL engineer. And I was writing that with my former writing partner, who is an operatic soprano and had much more experience as a music editor and a librettist. Look, it was about the history of the 110 freeway, which began in the Arroyo Seco at exactly the same time that the early JPL Rocketeers were beginning to set off their rockets. So although I worked on some of the lyrics and the book for that opera, what I mostly brought to the picture was an encyclopedic knowledge of Los Angeles history, of the history of Los Angeles that runs down the eastern part of the city. Hollywood and the beach and the fashionable West Side had been very heavily documented in popular culture and movies, but the eastern part of Los Angeles, the Jet Propulsion Lab, Pasadena, the Central Avenue where the jazz clubs were, the 110 freeway ran along this part of the city, and the opera was kind of a history of the city along the path of the opera, running both along the path of the freeway, rather, running both through time and space with emblematic characters drawn from different fields, an African-American journalist, a jazz musician, a Japanese-American artist, eventually, who, because the freeway began in 1939, she has a little segue into an internment camp, and a Jewish-American rocket engineer, sort of based on my dad and also based on the father of the composer of the opera who grew up in Boyle Heights, which, for anybody who knows Los Angeles, it's on the other side, it's on the eastern side of the Los Angeles River. It's part of Los Angeles. And in the early part of the 20th century, it was one of the very, very few communities that didn't have restrictive housing covenants. So if you wanted to have, a multi-ethnic cast from one neighborhood, they kind of had to be from somewhere like Boyle Heights, because in Boyle Heights it was possible for an African-American, a Latino, a Japanese-American, and a Jewish-American to all live on adjacent streets, which would not have been possible in communities like Hancock Park, farther to the west, or Beverly Hills, which was just beginning to blossom around that time. That's more than you ever wanted to know about Los Angeles, but I do love this city, I have to admit.
In 2012, you returned to the subject of the impact of female icons on our culture with the highly praised The Accidental Feminist, how Elizabeth Taylor raised our consciousness and we were too distracted by her beauty to notice. What drew you to the very talented and much married Miss Taylor?
Well, I never thought I'd write a book about Elizabeth Taylor, especially since what I was mostly writing at that time, were science pieces. But what happened there was, with some friends, younger friends, I wound up stuck in Palm Springs in a vacation house with a bunch of kids, Gen X, Gen Y, and they had absolutely no idea who Elizabeth Taylor was. Not that this came up, except that we were stuck in this house, and the only thing we had for entertainment for the first couple of nights were box sets of Elizabeth Taylor DVDs. So we thought for one night, we'll take a look at them. The Gen Y people really had no idea who she was. I mean, they knew she had some connection to film, vaguely, but they mostly knew her as, an AIDS philanthropist and an activist. And the Gen X people knew her primarily from the really derogatory Joan Rivers jokes in the 1980s about her. Things, really tasteless things about her weight, like more chins than a Chinese phone book, just vile. But that's what they knew. And we started, we thought we were going to have this evening of camp. And we started watching her movies and watching them in pretty much chronological order. And we were, I have to tell you, John, just blown away, not just by the quality of her performances, but by the relentless feminist messages in her important movies. Her first movie, National Velvet, made when she was 12. In this movie, her 12-year-old character challenges gender discrimination, excluded from an important horse race because she isn't male. She dresses as a male jockey and wins the race. exposing, you know, the pure bigotry of excluding women. Her next big important movie, A Place in the Sun, is an abortion rights movie. It's an adaptation of Theodore Dreiser's An American Tragedy about a working class man who impregnates a working class woman, but he who works in a factory with him, but he's also the nephew of the rich guy who owns the factory. And he, and after, well, he's Monty Clift, you know, of course he inadvertently, you know, impregnates someone. He's gorgeous.
Hello? We seem to be having some technical difficulties. All of a sudden, it's possible that her cell phone ran out of batteries. I'll have to, she's dropped off. I'll have to call her back and to see if we can get her back on the radio. Let's see. If not, perhaps I can ask a question via Facebook or something like that, and we'll see what happens.
John, I'm so sorry. I guess somebody doesn't like Monty Cliff. Was I getting so animated? I don't know what happened. Maybe the phone overheated. Sorry about that.
I do get very
animated about these movies.
Go on, you're talking about...
Monty Cliff and A Place in the Sun. Well, I mean, the short version is he falls in love with this beautiful woman. And the brilliant director of the film, George Stevens, realized that... Dreiser's An American Tragedy had been already adapted twice and adapted in ways that were very unsuccessful because basically the novel is sort of anti-capitalist agitprop. The factory girl is sweet. The man who impregnates her and who falls in love with the rich woman is not sympathetic. He's a social climbing cad. And the rich girl is no more than her money. But what George Stevens realized that in order to make this into a multi-Kleenex blockbuster, which it was, he had to really show the humanity and the vulnerability of these characters. So Shelley Winters, who played the factory girl, you know, is complicated. And Clift is sympathetic because... What Stevens realized that he needed to do was he needed the audience to understand that the Montgomery Clift character was not a social climber. He had genuinely fallen in love. And there's a lot of correspondence, you know, between him and the studio and his producer about casting. And as far as he was concerned, the only actress who could actually convince an audience that someone like the Monty Clift character had fallen in love with a woman and not with her money was the young Elizabeth Taylor. She was extraordinary. And basically the deal with abortion is, I mean, the mistress was pregnant. No pregnant mistress, no American tragedy. I thought that my friends and I might be projecting 21st century attitudes onto a mid 20th century movie. I hope you're still there.
I am.
Good. On to a mid-20s watch of the caprice with the phone around this movie. Onto a mid-20th century movie. So I didn't want to just write my analyses. I wanted some sort of objective historical evidence that what we had seen in all of these movies was actually there. And it was. And the validation came in the form of memos from the Production Code Administration. As you are, of course, aware, between 1934 and 1966, every word in American movies was controlled by the Production Code Administration, which it wasn't the Legion of Decency, although it's or the so-called Hays Code or Hays Office. But Will Hays, a former Postmaster General, had very little to do with the day-to-day running of this office. It was run by Joseph Bream, a sort of rabid lay Catholic. And what's fascinating is that everything we saw in these movies really, really, really upset the censors. The scene where Shelley Winters, as the pregnant mistress, asked the doctor for an abortion had to be rewritten 10 or 12 times. At some points, the actors had to communicate sophisticated ideas practically by telepathy. And yet, I mean, these actors were up to it. And that's why I think George Stevens selected Elizabeth Taylor, because she could convey so much without words. She could absolutely override an audience's prefrontal cortex and go right to the amygdala, the mother lode of emotion, particularly where things like simmering sexuality were concerned.
There was a very funny story from that movie in Shelley Winters' autobiography. If you remember, Shelley Winters, a lot of people only remember her from being a rather overweight, tacky blonde. She was a beautiful young woman. And apparently she shared a trailer with Elizabeth during the making of that movie. And she was writing a letter. And in those days, you obviously hand-wrote letters, and you put the date on top of it. And she said, "Elizabeth, what's the date?" And Elizabeth said, "I don't know." And she said, "Oh, well, there's a newspaper there, Elizabeth. Give me the newspaper. I can get it from there." And Elizabeth said, "It won't do any good. It's yesterday's paper."
Oh.
And when
funny.
I read that, my admiration for her acting didn't go down, but for her intelligence did. So.
Well, you know, I think she had a really terrible, she did not have a great education. She was a contract player with MGM, and she was taught at the Little Red Schoolhouse alongside Nancy Davis, who became, you know, Mrs. Ronald Reagan. But I actually think that she had an extraordinary native intelligence, and that she continued to learn throughout her life. And her teachers were people like the director George Stevens. You know, my actor friends tell me that not only do they bring their own things to roles, but they take things away. I think she learned an enormous amount from working with the directors and inhabiting that, from working with the directors that she worked with and inhabiting the roles that she did. For instance, in her 1956 movie, Giant, also directed by George Stevens, she portrays an educated woman from the East Coast who goes to Texas and marries Brock Hudson, who's a racist oaf, who severely mistreats his Mexican workers. And she's passionate about social justice. She's also passionate about women's rights. And there's a speech in that movie that, I should probably send you a link to it so you could, you know, piece it in or something. It's just extraordinary. But the idea that she would learn from her roles. In this movie, she's forbidden by her husband to go into the community of Mexican workers, but she defies him. She goes into their, you know, little peripheral community against his will. And there she finds a very sick baby who needs immediate medical attention. And instead of pushing the sick baby away for fear that the baby will infect her, she embraces this baby, and she forces the physician who had only treated the European-American ranchers. He refused to treat the Mexican and Mexican-American workers. She makes him recognize the humanity and the suffering of this baby, of this member of a marginalized community. And in the 80s, when Elizabeth got sober, and 1985, when her cherished friend, Brock Hudson, died of AIDS, not a lot of people in Hollywood were running to embrace, you know, people, the gay people stricken by this mysterious disease, you know, gay men who had contributed greatly to their profits in so many parts of the entertainment industry. But Elizabeth you know, was fiercely loyal in the same way that her character, Leslie, had been loyal and supportive of that baby. She embraced her friends, and she more or less forced the medical establishment, which had not devoted a lot of money or attention to AIDS, you know, to pay attention. She forced the mainstream to see the humanity and the suffering of a marginalized community. This was an observation made by Michael Gottlieb, who actually was Rock Hudson's physician and the physician who first identified the AIDS virus in the Journal of, you know, in the American, what is it, JAMA, J-A-M-A. You know, he is on record for having identified that. And, you know, her work with AIDS charities.
It's interesting.
Well, I mean, the CDC also was not rising to the occasion. In the first year of the AIDS epidemic, I don't have the book in front of me, but the numbers were very, it was the CDC devoted something like $1 million to AIDS research and preventive education and $3 million to Legionnaires' disease. And the CDC was slow to, the government was slow because many of the people afflicted by AIDS were gay men, and at that time the moral majority was openly contemptuous of gay men, and the president at that time felt that he owed his election, perhaps in large part, to the efforts of Jerry Falwell and the moral majority. The president of the United States didn't actually utter the acronym AIDS until 1987, well into the epidemic. But again, in 1985, Elizabeth began to work with AIDS Project Los Angeles, APLA, you know, phoning up her rich friends and spearheading a campaign to raise money for this disease. And her first fundraiser, which I believe was at the Bonaventure Hotel, her first fundraiser brought in more money than, you know, the CDC had spent on AIDS in the entire first year of the epidemic. And she continued to fundraise aggressively. I mean, I think she's really admirable. The sober person she became later in life. I mean, yeah, when she was an actress, directors saw things in her that it would take decades for her to see in herself and to realize how she could marshal those things, you know, for good in the larger world.
Some thoughts on what you just said. I stayed at the Bonaventure years ago. It was a terrific hotel. Her non-husband, other than her husbands, the men she was most associated with, and she called her best friends, were Rock Hudson, Montgomery Clift, Malcolm Forbes, James Dean, and they were all, at some point, came out or identified as homosexual, as well as Michael Jackson, who had a strange public sexuality. I think that's very interesting. She may have been associated with people who weren't the threat to her as this beautiful,
well,
sexual woman.
Her own father, Francis Taylor, was a pretty much an openly gay man, although he stayed married to Sarah Taylor, her mother. He lived pretty much openly at the Beverly Hills Hotel with Adrian, the costume designer, Gilbert Adrian, who went simply by the name Adrian, who did Adrian marry? Well, anyway, there was sort of a lavender scare in the late 30s where all the gay people had to be married off. But, I mean, Adrian and Francis Taylor didn't really conceal their relationship from the cognoscente in Hollywood. So, I think she had kind of grown up in a situation where she, you know, learned to be tolerant of, you know, to be tolerant and welcoming of this kind of diversity.
I was an Elizabeth Taylor fan. I still am. Maggie, her role of Maggie the Cat in Cat in the Hot Tin Roof and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf were my favorite movies, with Butterfield 8 not far behind. Which would you have favorite?
Oh, I love all of them. I think Butterfield 8 is an amazing. And also, I mean, her character's beliefs are very much in harmony with with like third wave feminism, the notion that a woman owns her own body and is not for sale. You know, at the beginning of that movie, she writes "no sale" on the mirror with lipstick because she doesn't want to be bought and paid for. There's a fabulous exchange with a really oily Lawrence Harvey where he starts offering her stuff, and more stuff, and she explains that she's turned it all down. And finally, he gets it, and he says to her, "Now I get it. You pick the man. He doesn't pick you." And she says, "Finally. Why I'm not teaching logic at Columbia, I'll never know." It's one of my favorite exchanges.
She had
She
had many interesting things. Well, I mean, her movies were banned in Egypt after the Mike Todd marriage, then her conversion to Judaism, then the Debbie Nanetti scene, then Burton, then being married to John Warner, then her desire to being the peacemaker, as though she seemed to feel that she could bring something to the Arab-Israeli conflict. And as you mentioned, her later embracement of trying to find an AIDS solution, she was all over the place. She was always in the news.
I think she took her conversion to Judaism very seriously. Speaking as someone who during 14 years of my unfortunate married life was Mary Grace Lord Horowitz, and I was the one who went to shul and studied Hebrew. I mean, I know what a challenge it is to convert to Judaism against the will of a husband, and Eddie Fisher did not want her to convert to Judaism, which he did in 1959, converted here in L.A. by Rabbi Max Nussbaum, and it was at that point that her films were banned in all Arab countries. And actually for that reason, Cleopatra had to be made in Italy, not Egypt, because neither she nor Eddie Fisher would be admitted to Egypt, or at least, you know, the studio feared that that would be the case. And I mean, throughout her life, she's been, even when AIDS seemed to take over as her primary philanthropic interest, she continued to support Israel. In 1977, when Uganda seized, hijacked an Israeli plane. Am I getting the year right, John? In any event, she offered herself as a hostage in exchange for the hijacked victims to the Israeli ambassador. And he didn't accept her offer, but he did write her a note saying, "You are Israel's greatest friend." And she continued to, you know, give a lot of money. In fact, in addition to converting to Judaism in 1959, she immediately bought $100,000 in 1959 dollars of Israel bonds. So I think Alicia Boat Rahel Taylor took her Judaism very seriously.
Her marriage to John Warner was very interesting. He was a very different type than the great Richard Burton or Eddie Fisher. I think when she married Eddie, no one thought that would last. Burton was the electric marriage, and John Warner was a very different type.
Well, she was not happy during those years. I think it was a real mismatch, and from his vantage, mostly a cynical mismatch to help get himself elected. She was very, very, very unhappy during those years and very much alone. And she talks in one of her sort of uplifting books that deals with her own weight loss. I mean, she gained all that weight. She was about 5'2", and she admitted to being at least 180 pounds during those years. And her principal, I mean, she spent all there. I guess her one might say her favorite foods during that period were bourbon, fried chicken, and Demerol. And that combo doesn't necessarily contribute to weight loss. But she really got her act together later, and I think it sounds exaggerated because during some of those years, I mean, she was self-indulgent and kind of sloppy, and yet still so brilliant on screen. She really did become a great moral voice of the late 20th century in the middle 80s through the 90s and into the beginning of the 21st century around the cause of AIDS. Which is great.
And when Burton died, she really took charge also, even though that he was married to another woman.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the people who helped me a lot on this book was Richard's daughter, Kate Burton, who has a really, you know, active career on Broadway and in television. I mean, she's all over network and cable these days. But we had sort of vaguely overlapped at Yale, and we had friends in common. And she read my book about my father. And I think she herself at some point may do a similar book about, you know, I mean, about admiring his craft, the craft of her father, but still, you know, having a difficult father. And she ran interference for me, with the family, which ordinarily, with the Taylor estate, which ordinarily would have just circled the wagons and excluded anyone who attempted to do any kind of a biography. And the book really is, I mean, I think that by looking at these roles in a way that people at the time didn't necessarily consciously view them, and yet they were getting these powerful unconscious messages, you know, feminist messages drummed at them. I think the family didn't object to this book. It doesn't make her a saint. I certainly acknowledge the fried chicken, bourbon, and Demerol aspects, but I think that the person she became at the end of her life definitely makes up for some of the excesses of her earlier years and her extraordinary performances. I agree with you, John. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? It's not a movie that's easy to watch, but I think it's one of the great movies of the. Certainly of the 60s, and I would say even the entire 20th century. It's just a fantastic film. I watched it so many times.
The book got very good reviews, and you must have been happy about that. So far, we haven't mentioned your teaching. When did you begin that, and what do you teach?
I teach just about everything, because I've kind of done just about everything. And I never thought I'd like teaching, but I don't have kids, and I find that I really, really enjoy a collection, a connection to younger people. I teach memoir. Memoir is history, actually, which is a little different than kind of regular self-indulgent memoir. It's what I did in AstroTurf. I mean, you own a story because of your connection to it, your personal connection, but then you also do some research. You know, I mean, you are a part of a larger story, and you situate your story in a larger historical narrative. I teach writing the personal essay. I teach drawing the graphic novel, which is what I'm doing now. I will leak that its central character is my cat George, and that it does deal with space exploration, but I won't say too much. I hope it will be out soon enough. I teach writing the graphic novel. And the big challenge for writers, of course, is collaborating with visual artists if someone doesn't both, I would say draw, but these days with computers, it's almost like if someone doesn't generate images versus, you know, understanding the arc of a story and writing dialogue in a scene. So the goal in that course is to give writers and artists a vocabulary, a common vocabulary, so they can explain, you know, what they want. Because the script for a graphic novel is not exactly a screenplay, it's not exactly a novel, it's definitely an interim step towards something finished. I teach writing about popular culture. I teach writing science as culture and writing science cross genres, which is fun. I get a lot of screenwriters to come talk to my class and real scientists. I love teaching. It's And as I said, at USC, I've had some really brilliant students, and I feel I'm so misanthropic, but dare I say, John, that I feel vaguely hopeful about the future just because I've encountered so many really smart students in my classes.
Yeah, I love teaching too, and I just happened to walk into it. How did you get into teaching? How long have you been at USC?
I started in 2006 or 2007, after some good reviews on AstroTurf. The USC libraries invited me to come speak, and I guess one thing led to another, and I was invited to teach just one course, which turned into several courses, which turned into a full-time appointment. And I really love it. I didn't think I would, but in fact, it also makes me feel like I'm helping to shape a new generation of writers, and it doesn't hurt that they're pretty smart to begin with.
You've had a wide and varied career. What's next after the graphic novel? Do you see any more slight tangents as you go forward?
Well, I think the graphic novel is my current obsession. I may do a little bit of a memoir about my life, but I'm waiting for more people to die.
We've covered.
I'm very excited about drawing again, and it's kind of time consuming, you know, because you have to work out every beat of a story that's the length of a novel, and then you have to work out every image and what page it's on, because the images that are on the left hand page affect how the viewer sees the images that are on the right hand page. So let's just say there are a lot of pages hanging in my office now. So I mean, I'm trying to figure out exactly what goes where before I can begin finishing that as a project. And I don't draw on the computer. I still use paper, but I realize that you have to submit your finished product as a printable PDF. So I'm learning more about Adobe Illustrator and Photoshop, and in this case, I'm paying some of my more technically adept students to teach me how to use the Cintiq, this drawing tablet, and, you know, these various programs. I still like pen and paper, but I recognize that we live in the 21st century, and I'm weaning myself slowly away from that old vice.
My son had cartoons published when he was 14 years old in a computer shop or in a computer paper in New York, and he was using programs to do that. And he hasn't done any cartooning since, but that was a lot of fun. One of my favorite mystery writers, Max Allen Collins, began as a comic book writer, and then he had novels and graphic novels, and then he had The Road to Perdition with Paul Newman. So he was all over the place, but he came from the comic book world.
Well, you know, one of the things about the program that I teach in, which may not go on forever, this program, so, you know, I would love to teach in a similar program somewhere if it doesn't continue, is that it's multidisciplinary. And I think you're absolutely right about the way that writers move between disciplines. I think in order to write long narrative nonfiction, you really have to understand screenplays. You have to understand a three-act structure, so your long narrative nonfiction will have a long arc and will move. And you have to know how to write a scene, because stories are made out of scenes. And the same thing, I would argue the same thing with screenwriters. I mean, it's very helpful if they understand some of the research discipline involved in reporting narrative nonfiction, you know, because screenplays can be very thin if they don't have any, especially historical screenplays are very thin if they don't have, you know, a sort of a researched spine running through them. And I also think in today's world, you really can't specialize that much. I mean, screenwriters blog. People do different, you know, people do many different things and have to. In order to function, I believe, as a writer today. I mean, yes, you can specialize, but I don't think you can ignore all the other disciplines that can lead to a person being called a writer.
It's interesting you talk about the research. My son's putting together the project on crime in New York in the early 20th century, and in doing his research, he came across the head of the New York Police Department pickpocket detail, who was his great-grandfather.
that's amazing.
Yeah.
That would actually be a pretty interesting memoir.
Yeah. We've covered a lot of bases in exploring your interesting and very productive life. What else would you like our audience to know about M.G. Lord?
Oh, I think, John, you've covered just about everything. I think... I think that pretty much covers it. I love Los Angeles. I love teaching. It's exciting to be able to draw again after many years of drawing for myself but not drawing professionally. Well, get me on a different day, and I won't say life is good, and I especially won't say life is good when the, when the political world is disintegrating around us. But this afternoon, maybe life is good.
Well, thank you very much, MG. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, John. It's been fun. One of these days we'll have to have a conversation that other people aren't overhearing.
And in the words of Met Radio, this announcer, Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. Turn in next week with my conversation with educator and computer scientist Janine Meyer. And until then, as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, steady, Silver, steady. ¶¶